The colonel will look into it, find out if it's worth reporting. Jesus, Sarge. Like I said, nasty. These people are primitives, pure and simple. Taking out this war on their own kind, on civilians. I told the lieutenant this ought to teach him not to get captured. I think he got that. Killian was there now, said, he'll not last long. Hell, what's his name? I forget. Welch said, Goolsby. You pay attention to him. He's young, but they sent him out here for a reason. He's got the bar on his shoulder, so you do what he says. If he was a screw-up, you can bet McCarthy would have tossed him out, sent him back to the colonel with a note pinned to his ass. Killian shook his head, stared that way. Those kind never make it, Sarge. He's already shaking in his boots. Smart-ass college boys. Damn 90-day wonders. Across the river, the echoing rumble of big guns was drawing everyone's attention, and Killian said, There's a pile of artillery letting loose out that way. Sure wish we had Craven out front. Welch sniffed. Lieutenant Craven's back home with his million-dollar wound, his feet up in his wife's lap, drinking six beers. You got a wife, right?
Yeah.
Well, you want to grab her soft rump again, you better pay attention right here. Be smart. You know how to keep your head down, and before we're done with this, you'll have reason. Count on it. Now we're moving up closer to the river. We can jabber about it later. Killian obeyed, and Welch motioned to Riley. Go on, you two. Keep an eye on Kane and his BAR. He's got two teenagers carrying his ammo, and I'm not sure any of them know what they're doing. According to our young Lieutenant Goolsby, Captain Zorn got a call from the colonel. When the word comes, we'll cross the river in front of us. Help out the first. Riley said, You mean in Seoul? Welch tilted his head. You've been taking geography lessons? Trying to take my job? Sarge, a monkey with VD could take your job. I heard the captain talking back at the boats. We're to head out around Seoul, help secure the city. I heard the captain, too. Seoul is supposed to be secure already. Big Brass has said so. Riley looked out ahead, focused on the artillery. That sounds secure to you? Up ahead, the men were moving to the edge of the road, dust rising from a line of trucks. Riley stood to one side, Welch beside him, the Red Crosses now in view. They moved quickly past, four ambulances, and from inside Riley could hear the soft moans, then a sharp cry as the trucks jolted over the rough road. The last truck was there now, and he saw Corman hanging off the rear, blood soaked through the man's sleeves. The corpsman glanced at the Marines along the road, who stared back at him, all of them blinking through the dust. The man's eyes met Riley's. A grim nod. The cold stare of a veteran. Welch said, I don't give a crap what kind of gift wrapping MacArthur or anyone else is trying to hand us. This fun's just starting. Chapter 3. Smith. September 21st, 1950. Did the general make his departure as scheduled, sir? Smith tossed his hat to one side, said, He left. The schedule belongs to him, so any time he leaves, it's on schedule. He regretted the sarcasm, saw Sexton looking down at the desk. The others turned to their work. A small crowd of officers filling the space in the command post, the silence awkward. Smith couldn't escape a foul mood. Thought, I have no time for this. Just don't ask me anything. From outside, Bowser came in. A bright smile said, Did you tell him, sir? Smith glared at him, but couldn't be angry with Bowser at all.
Tell him what?
If you'll allow me, sir. Smith wasn't sure what Bowser meant, but he trusted the man with any kind of information, as much as he trusted Eddie Craig or any of the others. Unlike Craig, Bowser had been with Smith for years, serving him now as the division's G3, the planning and operations officer, and less formally as Smith's assistant chief of staff. It was Bowser who had first briefed Smith on MacArthur's plans for the Inchon invasion, both men surprised that Smith, who would command the actual invasion force, had never been fully included in the planning. Alpha Bowser had just turned 40, was another of the veterans of the campaigns in the Pacific, and when Smith went to Korea, he was grateful to have Bowser assigned to his staff. Bowser brought a capacity for patience, and as Smith had quickly discovered when dealing directly with the communications from the 10th Corps, patience was critical.
End the mystery, Colonel.
Delighted to, sir. If you will all take note of this, General MacArthur made his latest farewell to us from Kimpo this morning. As his last official act on Korean soil, for this week anyway, he presented our illustrious commander with a silver star. Allow me to congratulate you, sir. Smith was annoyed, knew that Bowser was spilling out a truckload of his own sarcasm.
Stuff that, Colonel. A commendation like that is for combat, not for standing around looking official.
He looked at the others now, all eyes on him.
Make nothing of this, you understand? General MacArthur seems eager to award anyone at any time the mood strikes him. I will not celebrate such things that are not deserved.
No, no, keep your mouth shut. He pointed towards Sexton, seated at a small table, said to Bowser,
Give the thing to Captain Sexton. Hide it, Captain. No one mentions this again.
Sexton was smiling, the staff clearly not taking his anger seriously.
As you wish, sir. Should I send it home to your wife?
Smith tried to remove his gloom, to feel their mood, the entire staff enjoying the scene. He nodded, a hint of his own smile breaking through.
Fine. I'll have a letter for her today as well.
Sexton reached for a piece of paper on the desk, said, Oh, and this came for you, sir. I suspect Mrs. Smith might already be aware. Hard to keep this stuff quiet. Smith reached for the paper, said,
What is it now?
He read, Sexton not responding. He read again, wondered if there was some prankster at work.
This cannot be. I never thought that photographer was serious.
Bowser moved up beside him, peering discreetly at the paper, said,
Problem, sir?
Smith hung his head, the note crumpled in a wad.
I assume all of you know about this.
There were low mumbles of agreement, and Smith looked at Sexton, said,
You may inform Colonel Bowser. I can't do it.
Sexton stood, more ceremony than Smith wanted.
Colonel Bowser, it pleases me to report that our commanding officer, General O.P. Smith, has been anointed as our latest national celebrity. His picture will grace the cover of Time magazine for the week of 25 September.
Bowser stared for a moment at Sexton, then at Smith.
Good God, sir, you're a star. How'd this happen?
Sexton said, It seems that General MacArthur's praise for our commander's performance during the Inchon invasion was heard in all the right places. The reporter was one of the crew that followed the general here and there, mainly here.
Bowser said, Congratulations indeed, sir. It is certain that your wife will know of this as quickly as the rest of the country. She will be most proud, sir, as are we all.
Smith tossed the note into a trash can.
Just go back to work. The Inchon invasion has only begun. Lest any of you forget, we are taking casualties this very minute. Men are dying so that I can be on the cover of a magazine. I take no pride in that.
He knew he had drained away their morale, but would not apologize. This is MacArthur, he thought. This is how we fight his war. Ed Craig emerged from a smaller room, the space that served as Smith's own office.
Sir, we have received a communication from 10th Corps.
Fine.
He followed Craig back into the smaller room, a young corporal at the desk, pen in hand. Craig said,
You may leave. The young man stood quickly, made his way past the two officers, and Craig closed the rickety door behind him.
Smith said, What now?
Sir, we are receiving reports from the regimental level, particularly from Colonel Murray, that General Almond is issuing orders directly to those commands.
Your commands, sir.
He has apparently made good use of a small spotter plane and is dropping in on the various positions as he sees fit. I am told that the general has gone so far as to order the positioning of individual machine guns and mortar batteries. Colonel Murray is most unhappy with this, of course. Colonel Puller is... Well, he's Puller. You can imagine his response. Apparently, General Almond feels that by going directly to the front lines, as it were, he can speed things along.
Bypassing my command.
Craig nodded.
Yes, sir.
Smith felt lava boiling in his brain, clamped it down.
You said you had a communication?
Craig leaned out over the desk, searched, grabbed a piece of paper, handed it to Smith.
From General Almond this morning.
You are instructed to advance with all deliberate speed, capture the city of Seoul as ordered, with a minimum of destruction to the buildings in the city, and hasten the ongoing withdrawal of the enemy. This command anticipates that by your stout show of force, the enemy will make haste to avoid a significant confrontation. There must be no delay.
Smith said, He said this 3 days ago.
And 2 days ago, and yesterday. Smith tossed the paper on the desk.
There is apparently some displeasure at Corps HQ that the enemy is putting up a fight.
I would disagree, sir. There is displeasure that this division is behaving as though there is an enemy in the first place. Intelligence continues to insist that the bulk of the North Korean forces have vacated Seoul and are retreating up through Wijeongbu, near the border.
And yet, General Almond is issuing orders to men in the field engaged in a fight that his own people are telling him doesn't exist?
That sounds accurate, sir.
There was a soft knock, and Smith turned, pulled the door open. Bowser. No smile now.
What is it, Colonel?
Sir, General Lowe has returned, wishes to speak with you. Sorry.
Smith looked at Craig, cocked a finger over his shoulder, the silent order to leave. Craig moved past him, tapped him on the back.
We're with you, sir. Every damn one of us.
Smith stood alone for a long moment, the air thick in the small room, the smell of smoke and paperwork. He reached into his pocket, withdrew a pipe, sniffed the bowl, the tobacco still fresh. He would rarely smoke around any other brass, certainly not MacArthur, and never in any kind of high-level meeting. But there were times...
Ah, General, pleasure to see you again. General Lowe, do come in. Sorry there isn't more, luxury.
Nonsense. Mind if I sit? An hour bouncing in a jeep is a different kind of luxury.
Smith motioned to a small folding chair, low, easing down, a slight grimace on his face. Smith moved behind the small desk, sat as well, waited for whatever the man had to say. Major General Frank Lowe had arrived a few days before, carrying the only authorization required for him to be any place he wanted to be. He was there specifically as an observer for President Harry Truman and carried no authority to lead troops, had no command status, and from what Smith could tell, was perfectly content just watching anything worth watching. Lowe was older than Smith, mid-60s, but his bearing was similar to Smith's, a tall, thin, straight-backed man. His qualifications came more from his friendship with Truman than from any particular military expertise, even the rank something of a mystery. Lowe had planted himself into Smith's command, had even brought a cot to share Smith's meager quarters. Smith had been anything but happy with Lowe's arrival, but warmed to the man quickly. Lowe had no caginess about him, had freely admitted his reasons for being there, to communicate his personal observations to the president on a nearly daily basis.
I've been with Colonel Puller today. Quite a scamp, that one. Most accommodating, though. Rather in a mess up there, making progress despite some rough going. He's inflicting enormous casualties among the enemy, no doubt about that.
You tell the president all of that?
Indeed. As I've said, General, I'm happy to share those dispatches with you.
Smith shook his head.
No, your position here is clear. I prefer you keep your correspondence private. If I read what you're saying, you might feel you should edit something, some observation about me. That wouldn't be appropriate.
If you say so, General. But I must say, everything I have observed here will be most satisfactory to the President. He has concerns, of course, and he hopes I can cut through some of the official blather.
The name burst into Smith's head. MacArthur. Of course. That's the whole point. Mac will tell Washington what he wants them to hear. At least Truman is trying to go a little deeper than the headlines.
How long do you expect to be here, General?
Please, I do wish you would call me Frank. We may share rank, but mine comes from the discretion of the President. Yours is well earned.
Thank you, but that's difficult for me. My staff knows I don't usually get terribly familiar, even with them.
As you wish, General. I'm not certain how long I will be here. Are you willing to offer some prediction just how long this effort will take?
As long as it takes,
Lowe smiled.
Of course.
Well, then, I might be here for the duration, unless the president changes his mind.
You'll keep us on our toes, then. Can't hurt.
I'd rather not have it that way. I'm not here to grade your performance. This is much more about the progress of the campaigns, the effectiveness of our strategy against the communists. What happens in Korea might well presage what happens everywhere else in the world. This is not a vacuum. The Russians are testing our resolve.
I don't know much about the Russians, General Lowe. I'm concerned with those people out there killing my Marines. My job, unless someone tells me different, is to eliminate the North Korean army. That would be the most effective way to end this war.
Lowe seemed to appraise Smith. Said nothing. That will end up in one of his blooming letters, Smith thought. He stood abruptly, felt the need for air.
Remain here if you wish. Speak to any of my staff as you require it.
Lowe laughed.
But stay the hell out of your way, right?
Never said that, General Lowe. You are apparently my guest. Anything you need or need to see, just ask. General Craig will see to it. He moved out the door, eased past his staff, the larger door that led outside. Behind him, Sexton scrambled to catch up, said,
Sir, might I know where you're going?
Come with me if you like. Just going outside. Sexton followed him, and Smith realized the pipe was still in his hand. He lit it now, drew in the luscious smoke, and Sexton said,
How is it, sir? To your liking?
Smith focused on the scent of the tobacco.
Yes, quite so.
He recalled now it was Sexton who had secured the pipe tobacco, the one brand Smith preferred, Sir Walter Raleigh.
Thank you, Captain.
Sexton smiled, a short bow.
I put aside a good haul for you, sir. I keep it with my personal equipment. Ought not run out any time soon.
Smith thought of Lowe's question. How long?
What do you think, Captain? We in for a long haul here? Or you think Tokyo's right, that this thing won't last but a few weeks?
No idea, sir. I kind of hoped you could tell me. Maybe General Lowe might have some notion. He's Army, right, sir? Does he know what MacArthur's planning?
Smith enjoyed the pipe for a long moment, said,
He's not about to go any closer to MacArthur than he has to. Right now, he's Mr. Truman's one-man army,
The president believes he has to send a spy of sorts out here to find out what's happening.
A spy? Really?
Don't get excited, Captain. Real spies don't go around telling everyone what they're doing. He's just the president's eyes and ears.
It's a mystery to me why Mr. Truman needs such a thing.
That's what official communications are supposed to do. But apparently, Mr. Truman doesn't believe everything he hears.
Do you, sir? Smith thought of the intelligence reports. G2 section in Tokyo insisting the North Koreans were just fading away.
Not a question you should be asking, Captain.
10th Corps Headquarters, Yeongdong-po, South Korea, September 24, 1950. No one seemed particularly happy to see him, something Smith was getting used to. Almond was leaning low over large maps, spread out across a long table. Various staff moved about, and Smith wondered how many of them actually had something to do. It was never far from Smith's mind that Almond was still wearing the crown of MacArthur's chief of staff. For reasons known only to MacArthur, Almond was continuing to hold two crucial jobs. At one end of the table stood General David Barr, the commander of the Army's 7th Division. Barr was nearly Smith's age, had enjoyed a lengthy, if not terribly distinguished, career that went back to World War I. He seemed a pleasant enough man, had shown Smith a willingness to cooperate alongside the Marines as much as Smith required him to. It had not escaped Smith that Barr seemed as unimpressed with Almond as Smith had been.
"General Barr, hello."
Barr offered a weak smile, said,
"Is our boundary to your satisfaction, General?"
"On General Almond's order, we have moved our 32nd Regiment in place even now, covering your right flank. There seems to be some stubbornness on the part of the North Koreans about our liberation of Seoul. I wish your people the best of success."
It was a pleasant surprise, Barr acknowledging that, for now anyway, the job of pushing into the city belonged to the Marines, the Army troops acting as protection to the south along Chesty Puller's vulnerable right flank.
"Thank you, General. We're making progress, but it's a little tougher than predicted."
Both men looked directly at Almond, who seemed oblivious to the conversation. Almond straightened, seemed to notice Smith for the first time.
"Ah, welcome. Good. The party's all here. I had hoped to go over troop dispositions and offer you both some ideas of my own. Tokyo is rather insistent that we pick up the pace a bit. I've instructed both of you to make haste, and there is some concern that things are, dragging. There are many eyes on us, gentlemen. The world is watching. We must live up to the reputation that brought us here in the first place. Our gallant troops deserve no less."
Smith nodded along with Barr, thought, "Perfect politics. The most important eyes watching you are in Tokyo." To one end of the room sat a small cluster of civilians, silent, observant, whom Smith assumed to be reporters. Of course, he thought. Those eyes, too. Almond spread his arms apart, hands out, as though gathering in the room.
"Gentlemen, particularly you, General Smith, I am confident that we will triumph in a timely way, satisfying our assignment as prescribed by General MacArthur. General Barr, you will move the 32nd Infantry across the Han River at 0600 tomorrow. Smith, you get your Amtraks on the road right now. There is no time for delay. I have taken steps to light a bit more of a fire under the backsides of a few of your officers. Colonel Puller and Colonel Murray are aware of my orders and have agreed to my plans for the envelopment of Seoul."
Smith felt something snap inside him, ignored the others, said in a low hiss,
"General Almond, might I have a word with you?"
Almond seemed surprised, said, "You may speak freely here."
"I prefer a private moment."
Almond held on to his blanket of smugness, moved to the far end of the room, the staff making way, the men shifting position to the opposite end. Smith knew it was all he was going to get, and he followed Almond, kept his back to the others. The fury was complete. Smith's hands clenched, his heart beating rapidly, and he hesitated, thought, he wants witnesses. Smith took in a long breath, tried to calm himself. The words came in a low growl. General Almond, I'm aware you have issued orders directly to my regimental commanders in the field. In the future, I would appreciate it if you give those orders to me, and I will relay them to my subordinates. It is chain of command, General. He paused, waited for some reaction from Almond, but the maddening smugness remained, and Almond said, I never gave direct orders to any of your command, General Smith. I offered my suggestions as to their deployment, based on my knowledge of events as they are. I assure you I am not handling your regiments. I am just seeing how they do after you handle them. The wall of arrogance was a mile thick, Smith realizing Almond had the upper hand. He stared hard at the man, tried to find the weak point, the place to dig in. But Almond was too good at this game. He moved past Smith, said to the rest of the men, If we have no further discussion, my orders are plain and have been given to your staffs. My goal here is to capture the capital with a minimum of energy expended by squeezing the enemy until he is forced to retreat wholesale. Around the room, the others were staring intently at both men, and Smith knew his words to Almond had been heard by all of them. Almond continued, his voice rising. If the enemy chooses to continue his futile efforts against us, we must crush him where he sits, and do it with all speed. Smith moved up beside Almond, said, And you would have us destroy the city? That is unnecessary. Your orders already issued have called for us to preserve the buildings, not to obliterate the place. I am certain that we can surround Seoul with the troops we now have available, and by cutting the enemy off from escape and resupply, he will have no alternative but to surrender. This enemy will not respect maneuver, a pincer movement, or any other kind of dance. He will only respond in our favor if he has no other choice. The city of Seoul has 1 million inhabitants. It does not have to be a casualty of this war. Would not General MacArthur prefer we return Syngman Rhee, his capital, in one piece? Almond turned toward him, a different look, grim anger. But he forced a smile, said, The orders are as written, Smith. An envelopment would take far too much time. I had hoped the enemy would have recognized the hopelessness of his situation by now and made good his full retreat. If he remains, he will be crushed. This meeting has concluded. You may all return to your commands. Marine Division Command Post, near the Han River, September 25, 1950. The order came after dark, nearly 8 o'clock, while most of the Marines were standing down. All of them knew that the dawn would send them out against the enemy once more, another hard, slugging match to push the North Koreans through the streets of the capital. But to Smith's surprise, his superior had a new plan. 10th Corps Tactical Air Commander reports enemy fleeing city of Seoul on road north of Ujongbu. Heavy air attacks are ongoing and will continue. You will push attack now to the limit of your objectives in order to ensure maximum destruction of enemy forces. Signed, Almond.
Is this certain? Who did you speak to? Ruffner?
Bowser nodded. I spoke with Colonel Chides first, the G3. He told me that we were to carry out this order as written. I called back and got General Ruffner and asked him for reaffirmation. Smith ran a hand over his forehead. He had no reason to doubt Bowser. Did you explain to those people that attacking at night in an unfamiliar city is not advisable? Particularly since there is no indication the enemy is going anywhere across this entire division front?
All of that, sir. General Ruffner told me the order had been dictated by General Almond himself, and that it was to be executed without delay.
Get Murray on the phone. Puller won't take as long to get ready. Call him next.
Sir, are we to just order the men to march straight into the enemy,
in the dark?
Those are the orders, Colonel.
As the 5th and 1st Marine Regiments scrambled into readiness for the midnight assault, another report came in to Smith's HQ. A Marine forward observer north of the city, positioned along the very road the Air Command had claimed as the enemy's line of retreat, observed North Korean tanks and soldiers on the move. But they were not moving north. They were adding to the strength of those forces already inside of Seoul. Instead of a retreat, it was a counterattack.
Chapter 4. Riley. Near the Han River, northwest of Seoul, September 25, 1950.
Where's that kid? Captain wants latrines, and he's the one to do it.
There was little response, the men mostly hunkered down in shallow foxholes, making good use of the darkness to avoid Sergeant Welch altogether. Riley knew Morelli would speak up, the boy just too eager to please.
You mean me, Sarge?
It was just the enthusiasm Riley expected, and he knew Welch was smiling, the darkness hiding their faces.
Welch said, Sounds like you. 8 years old, right? My favorite volunteer.
Riley laughed to himself, his knees drawn in tight, his sleeping bag beneath him. Killian sat across from him, both men belching their dinner. An odd mix of sea rations and some kind of local meat, courtesy of some South Korean Marines. Killian said,
He'll do it with a smile, too. Don't know why the young are so stupid. Any dirty job and those kids still think it's a good idea to volunteer.
Riley didn't answer, had dug his share of latrines. He could hear the movement close by, Morelli pulling out his entrenching tool, the telltale clank of clumsy hands working the metal.
Where, Sarge?
Riley shook his head silently.
Heard Welch. Down that hill there. You don't put the damn things next to where you sleep. Jesus. I want a 1-2-3 trench. You got that?
Killian called out.
Hey, Sarge, you better show him how.
Welch was there now, a shadow standing over them.
I got a better idea, Irish. You show him. Right now. Off your ass.
Killian grumbled, stood slowly, knew there was no arguing with Welch. He climbed up from the small depression, disappeared into the dark, the voice of the kid following him.
1-2-3?
Killian responded.
1 foot wide, 2 feet deep, 3 feet long. You ask me again, and I'll put you in it head first.
The voices trailed away, and Riley leaned back against the rocky dirt, Welch sitting down beside the foxhole.
He'll be all right, just green, like you on Guam.
The memories came now, 1,000 years ago. Riley said, no greener than you, around the gills, too. Didn't think one man could throw up that many times. Welch laughed.
My damn gut's still sore. Didn't think I'd ever eat again.
Riley felt the familiar rumble down low, said, Hey, maybe you better tell him to hurry it up with that trench.
What was that we had for dinner anyway?
Pork. The South Korean officer came through this afternoon, and I guess he hit it off with old Homer. Sent a flock of pigs our way. I thought we might have an old-fashioned barbecue, but the Koreans showed the cooks what to do. Big mistake, maybe. I always heard Korean pigs weren't fit to eat. Riley was gingerly caressing his stomach. I'm not convinced either way. Talk to me in the morning.
Jarheads, listen up.
Riley knew the voice of the captain, the low talk all around them falling silent.
Where's Lieutenant McCarthy?
Welch stood, moved that way, said,
H station, sir, checking on Rickman.
That's okay, but I want him back quick. Where's the adjutant, the new man?
Oh, hell, what's his name?
Lieutenant Goolsby, sir.
Yeah, Goolsby.
He went with Lieutenant McCarthy.
Of course he did.
10 minutes and you send someone to get both of them, right?
Yes, sir. What's up, Captain?
Orders. There's a bee's nest at division. Whole regiment getting ready to move.
All I know. Find your lieutenants.
Zorn moved off quickly, his voice coming again, farther, more instructions for the next platoon.
Riley rose up, Welch standing close to him. Riley glanced skyward. A scattering of stars through patches of clouds. He thought of Rickman, the platoon's first casualty.
Riley didn't know him well, a quiet man, all business, hit by a sniper on the advance that morning. The bullet found Rickman's gut, the impact dropping the man in a tight curl. They didn't hear the shot, the sniper far away, and the men responded by flattening out anywhere they happened to be. But McCarthy had pulled them back up, a sharp order to keep them moving. Goolsby had scampered all through the platoon, hauling the men back into line, McCarthy watching him with a hard stare. Riley had been impressed by that. The new lieutenant doing the right thing, not allowing the men to slow their own advance by reacting to an enemy that was so far away. He could feel the men rising up, the fresh foxholes emptying, sleeping bags rolled tight, gear pulled together. Riley did as they all did, responding to the captain's orders. Killian was back, hard breathing, tossed the small shovel into the hole. Welch was moving through the men, came close now, said, "Well, Irish, I guess you owe me a latrine."
"Yeah, I heard. What's up, Sarge?"
"Orders to move." Welch raised his voice.
"Check your weapons. Make sure you got plenty of ammo."
Riley pulled himself up, said, "Captain didn't say anything about fighting. We just advancing?"
"I didn't ask him, Pete. Somebody shoots at your ass, I expect you to shoot back."
Killian grabbed for his gear, cursed, said,
"There's mail. Truck just pulled up back by the captain's CP. Damn it all, I'm expecting a pile of stuff from my wife, and my kid's just learning to draw pictures."
Welch said, "It can wait. We figure out where we'll be tomorrow night, that truck will still be there."
"Why the hell were you at the CP? You planning to dig your hole next to the captain's bedroll?"
Killian didn't respond, and Riley glanced around, said, "Where's the kid?" Killian kept working, said,
"Hell if I know. He followed me back here, I think. I'm not his damn nursemaid."
Riley searched the darkness, shadows and motion, low talk, the muffled sounds of equipment. Beside him, Welch said,
"Let it go, Pete. He won't get lost. Scared of the dark, so he'll head for the noise."
Killian made a nervous laugh.
"Yeah, great for a Marine. Run to Mommy when the sun goes down."
Welch moved away, and Riley picked up the M1, rubbed his hands down the stock, wiping away any dirt, felt the bandolier of magazines around his waist, a quick touch to the four grenades on his chest. He searched the dark again, said to Killian, "You should have kept an eye on him. He's too green." Through the darkness, a stumble, heavy breathing, the voice came now, high-pitched, excited.
"Fox Company? 3rd Platoon?"
Riley felt a hint of relief, said,
"Yeah, kid, you're in the right place."
"We're moving, huh? In the dark? Won't be light for a while."
Killian sniffed.
"Hell, kid, it's not even midnight. Just don't fall asleep and run up my ass."
Riley ignored Killian's disdain, said, "Get your gear together. Don't leave anything behind."
"Yeah, yeah, okay."
Morelli moved off to his own foxhole, and Riley slung the M1 onto his shoulder, heard Zorn again with another officer, pulling the men together, hushed orders, the urgency rolling through all of them. There was rifle fire, a heavy machine gun, then more, out to one side. He caught a glimpse of tracers, red, comforting, their own fire. But now the North Koreans were answering. Blue tracers. Something new. He stared for a long moment. The kid again, close beside him.
"What's all that? We going that way?"
Riley had no time for a lesson, the tension rising inside him. "We're going where they tell us. You got your rifle?"
"Right here. I'm ready. I'm ready."
The tension in the boy's voice bordered on panic, and Riley grabbed Morelli's bony shoulder.
"Calm down, kid.
We start moving, there might be enemy, or maybe not. We might just be moving to fill in empty ground.
Stay low. Don't shoot at anything unless you're sure. The captain will tell us what's up. He could feel a shiver in the boy's arm. Tried to avoid that himself.
It's dark, Pete.
Yeah, kid. It's dark. The sounds came first. The hard rumble of a tank, the harsh whisper from in front, the men responding by sliding off the road, lying low, blind. Riley felt soft, wet grass beneath him, lay on a slope, his feet in something wet. The roar from the tank was closer, the ground vibrating, voices, strange, foreign. He rose up slightly, strained to see, the great hulk in the road coming closer, and now a heavy foot in the middle of his back. He grunted, rolled, the man tripping, a cry, surprise. Riley pulled the M1 up, tried to catch details, anything. The man jogging up into the road, more men, the voices growing, and now a bright light blinding from the tank. The firing began, all sides of him, the others in the ditch spraying the tank, the men who kept close to it. Riley felt the desperate agony of fear, searched still for the man who had stepped on him, the spotlight now moving past him, fire on both sides. He fought to see, kept flat, cold screams in his head, the terror of the darkness. He held himself low, still, the sounds of a growing fight all around him. The light was out now, the tank peppered by fire from the Marines on both sides of the road, the great beast answering with machine gun fire of its own. The Koreans were shouting, orders, noise, a bugle, the chaos swallowing Riley, swallowing all of them. The road was alive with men, most of them jogging toward the Marines, some stopping to fire. Flashes of light, heavy footsteps moving past him in the ditch. He watched them come. Searched for the good target, but there were too many, the fire whistling past him from both sides. One man moved up slowly, close, and Riley reached out, grabbed the man's leg, pulling him down in a heap, the man rolling over Riley's body. He pulled the knife, a quick lunge, the Korean crying out, another lunge. Soft flesh, the Korean down beneath Riley, still no sounds. The man's stink engulfing him. Riley's breaths were hard and heavy, thunder in his chest, and he rolled himself upright to his knees, the knife in one hand, the fury, the hate, preparing him to do it again. And now a machine gun opened up, far down the road, behind the Marines, the spray of lead ripping above him. He flattened, a silent curse, could hear men hit, falling, hard cries, more Koreans crawling close to him. He let them go, the machine gun fire too close. Nothing to do but stay low. There was a massive blast, burst of fire, the tank erupting 30 yards away, the fire illuminating the roadway. Another machine gun chimed in, tearing up the road, slicing through the Koreans who scrambled for cover. He stared at the tank, flames erupting from inside, enemy troops scrambling away, leaving their steel protection. He pulled the M1 up, no aim, jabbed it into a man's groin as he passed, fired, then rolled over, found another target, easy now, the flames on the tank lighting the scene. He pulled the M1 to his shoulder, fired again, the Korean a few feet away falling forward. There were more, coming back along the road, some cut down quickly by the machine gun, most in a full run. He searched for another target, fired again without aim, then again. Now their voices changed. Marines, moving up closer, calling out, rapid fire from carbines and rifles. The machine gun silent. The tank continued to burn, the bodies in the road bathed in orange light, and he stayed on his knees, eyes on the tank, men beneath it, burning bodies.
Up, let's go, spread out into the field, they'll be back.
He knew Zorn's voice, pulled himself up, stepped down through the muddy ditch, a deep puddle. He struggled to stay upright, keeping his balance, his knees, soft rubber. The flames lit the field, taller grass, voices around him, orders, other men moving with him.
He felt the water, the splashes high. More orders. Men put into position. A line. The men settling down. Good cover. He flattened out. Water soaking through his clothes. The smells engulfing him. Sickening. The sudden clarity. The turn of his stomach. It was a rice paddy. The North Koreans kept up their advance for several hours. Every road or trail alive with troops, more tanks offering them cover and added firepower. The fights were mostly confused and meaningless, but the Marines had the advantage of greater firepower, machine guns moving up quickly, mortars put into place. The surge by the North Koreans began to run dry, exhausted by their casualties, by the tenacity of the men who fought them. For most of the night, the Marines pushing their way into Seoul itself advanced along dark streets, confronting blockades of rice bags, heavy machine guns seeking targets in a confused melee, casualties mounting on both sides. By early morning, the North Korean resistance had seemed to weaken, but the advance was slow, many of the Marines holding tight to the ground they had already earned. Despite the attack orders the Marines had received from 10th Corps HQ, their own commander understood that a full-blown frontal assault down 100 narrow streets was suicide. With the Marines digging in, preparing to hold off any new push by their enemy, orders were given for a new tactic. As the sunrise spread slowly over the smoking ruins of Seoul's outskirts, the 11th Marine Artillery Regiment went to work. Pressured to capture the capital by MacArthur's deadline, Oliver Smith used the most effective weapon he had against a stubborn, well-fortified enemy. If the fight between men was mostly equal, the Americans' heavy artillery tipped the scale. Throughout the bombardment, the 5th and 1st Marines could only wait, hoping the artillery would do the job. Flanked by the 7th to the north and the Army's 32nd to the south, the Americans closer to the city pulled into a tighter arc, pressing the North Koreans on three sides. With daylight, once again, the push would begin through the streets of Seoul. The artillery had weakened the enemy, but the fight would continue. Slow yet steady progress by the Marines, whose training had rarely included house-to-house searches. The Marines facing the enemy did not know of the orders first given to Oliver Smith, that the ancient architecture of the historical city be saved, a gesture of ignorant futility from Ned Almond. Amon's orders had now become a contradiction, his need to satisfy MacArthur forcing him to rush the entire operation. Despite 10th Corps' fairy tale hopes that the enemy would simply vanish, Smith and the Marines understood that the city would not be taken without a serious struggle, and so, when Smith called on his artillery, the results were inevitable. The big guns punished not only the enemy, but the historic capital itself. With the Marines renewing their hard push against the battered enemy, they drove down the narrow streets of a city that lay mostly in ruins. Northwest of Seoul, September 26th. With the daylight came a closer examination of the tank. The hole blasted through the turret with perfect aim. Captain Zorn leaned in close, said aloud, "Who did it?" One of the other lieutenants, the 2nd Platoon's commander, Peterson, moved up, said, "Speak up! Who did this?" The men gathered, all eyes on the hole in the tank. Behind Riley, one of the sergeants, "Sir, my man won't claim it, but I'm pretty sure it was Brubaker." "Front and center, Corporal." Brubaker obeyed, a sheepish grin on his face, said to Zorn,
"It was the M-20, sir. Bazooka. Hell of a gun, that one. I must have got lucky."
Zorn stood with his hands on his hips, glanced at Brubaker, then back to the tank. "We all got lucky, son. You keep that M-20 close at hand. I'm asking battalion for a dozen more. Who was on the machine gun?" A voice came out to one side. No hesitation.
"That was Private Atkinson, sir, one of the heavies."
Zorn looked that way.
"Where is he?"
"I positioned the heavies back on that low ridge. He's out to the left."
Zorn stepped away from the tank, stared out to the ridge, called,
"Atkinson, you got Spittin' Sally?"
Riley looked out that way, saw a man standing, one arm in the air, the response,
"Right, Jerry, yes, sir."
There was laughter. Riley, not sure what any of this meant. Zorn stood out in the road, said,
"Some of you have names for your rifles. Not sure I've heard of a name for a heavy machine gun. Gentlemen, your bacon was saved this morning by Spittin' Sally. You get a chance, pay your respects."
Riley didn't know many of the men in the machine gun squad. Saw their lieutenant, Hill, a smiling nod toward Zorn.
"Thank you, sir. Atkinson keeps this up. May have to put him in for a citation." Zorn said, "Don't forget Sally."
The laughter came again, the stress of the morning drifting away, relieved by the few moments of humor. Zorn seemed to understand that, called out now,
"Move out into that field. Take up along the highest ground. Battalion is keeping us along this road in case the enemy makes another try."
He seemed to search, then said,
"We got the enemy body count?"
It was Goolsby, unexpected, the youngest officer in the company, stepping forward.
81, sir.
Prisoners?
20, I think.
Zorn glanced at McCarthy, then stared at Goolsby for a long moment.
"Write it down, Lieutenant. I'll give that to battalion. Those kinds of numbers will make Major Sawyer pretty happy. Good ratio. All right, move out up that hill. Eyes open, dig in. Not sure how long we'll be here. Huizhongbu is up that road a few miles. My CP will set up back behind that ridge. I want to be close to Sally."
The fight early that morning had been a rapid-fire nightmare, but Riley knew the men had been buoyed by Zorn talking to them. Felt that himself. He knew little about the battalion commander, Buzz Sawyer, even less about Litzenberg. But none of them lorded over their commands with that peculiar attitude that seems to tell their men that whatever is happening now is simply an inconvenience, that the senior officers have their eye mainly on a different prize, putting an eagle or even a star on their shoulder. Riley had seen that in the Pacific, officers who ignored everything but the spotlight. Hopefully, he thought, that's not Zorn. He stepped along a path, men in front of him, and behind him, Killian.
"Well, what the hell happened to you? You smell worse than Korea."
The wetness in Riley's clothes had mostly dried, the odor a part of him now. He looked back, said,
"No, you stupid son of a bitch, I smell exactly like Korea."
"Where the hell were you, anyway? I don't see any of that damn rice paddy on you." Killian was beside him now, gave him a sharp rap on the back.
"Brains, skinny boy. Found a good spot on dry ground. Took down a few of those bastards, too. Hell, might give the M1 a name. How about Deadly Dixie? Maybe the captain will give me something, too. Those gunnies get all the attention."
"They earn it."
"The captain's right. That heavy kept us alive. We'd have been trampled by those bastards no matter how good your cover was." Killian said nothing, both men moving with the others farther up the hill. He saw McCarthy now, Welch and the other sergeants around him. Welch saw Riley, called out,
"This way. Take position back of this rise. Dig in, eat something."
Riley passed Welch now, followed the directions, caught the smell, worse than his own.
"Damn, Sarge, you fall into something nasty? Your mama's bathrobe. Get moving."
Riley smiled to himself. Knew he'd have to top that one. They were spread out in a ragged formation, more than 200 men, other companies positioned beyond. Down the sloping ground towards Seoul, he could hear the clatter of heavy weapons. That fight not slowing. And he thought of those men, no names, no friends that he knew of. They got none of this, he thought. No time for laughter, for a company commander to test the mood of his men. He stared that way, a low haze of smoke rising over distant houses, saw more Marines moving out on another trail. Another battalion adding to the force that was to keep the North Koreans from escaping the city, from slipping away. He was suddenly very tired, realized there had been no sleep at all. He thought of the man he had knifed, fought against ever thinking of that at all. But the moment would find its way down into that hole, join the other memories,
the other horrors. One more kill, he thought. Him, not me. He sat in the hole, shifted himself, pushed rocks out of the way, tossed one out of the hole. Killian was kneeling at the far end of the hole, digging into his bag, and Riley thought of the captain's words, something to eat. He put one hand on his stomach, no appetite at all, his own odor engulfing him. He watched Killian pull something from his bag, a small can with no label. Hey, Sean, you ask about the mail?
Lieutenant Goolsby said tonight, if the Nooks leave us alone, ammo carriers be coming up too.
Riley was surprised. You talked to Goolsby? Killian shrugged.
Well, he's a platoon officer, right? He's sorta in charge. Figure he'd know.
Riley recalled the criticisms of the man from days before, all the talk about 90-day wonders. Guess maybe he'll work out okay, huh? Killian focused on the can, stabbed it with his knife.
So far, ain't screwed up yet. But Rickman getting hit bugged him too much. He says it's serious. Rickman's going back to a hospital. McCarthy's okay with it, best as I can tell. But I'm guessing Goolsby's got green guilt.
Riley knew the phrase, shorthand for a new officer's inevitable response when he takes his first casualty.
No time for that. Not after today.
Killian swiped a finger through the open can, which seemed to be fruit cocktail.
Nope, he'll learn. This thing gets hot, won't be time to hand-hold every wounded man. Kinda looking forward to it.
Riley tried to feel an appetite again, couldn't erase the smell. Why you say that? You enjoy what we went through last night?
Sure. Hardest part was finding a damn target. Ain't like deer hunting. You hit one of these yellow bastards, he goes down in a heap. If you miss him, he runs for the hills.
Sounds like deer hunting to me. Killian sat down in the trench now, set his rifle upright beside him.
You ain't never killed no deer.
Once? Well, no, I missed him. He ran like hell, just like the enemy.
Where are you from, anyhow? Thought you'd be from the city like me. I went hunting with my family, upstate New York.
Riley said, Pennsylvania, apple country, lots of deer.
Shooting at Nooks no different. Dead's dead.
Riley held his response, thought, you couldn't be more wrong, Irish. The image of the knifing came again, the cries, the hard grunts, the man's smell. They fell silent now, low talk around them from the others. But with the quiet came the sounds from Seoul, never-ending. Skirmishes and raw combat, an excruciating reminder to Riley that the heavy lifting was being done by someone else. He avoided looking that way, nothing to see. Could hear Morelli talking to the man in his foxhole, lively chatter about New Jersey. I wonder if he had fun, too. I wonder if he put his knife through a man's chest. He closed his eyes, tried to shut down the voice in his head, but the fighting in Seoul rolled on in the distance, a chorus of rattling machine guns, a song from the kind of hell that boys like Morelli didn't know existed.
Chapter 5. Smith. Seoul, September 29th, 1950. The jeep was tilting to one side, making for a nervous ride, made more so by the heavy load on the meager springs. Puller sat in the front seat, Eddie Craig in back beside Smith. They had come from Puller's new command post in the city, the Duck Soo Palace. But Smith had first come into the city across the Han River on a brand new bridge. The orders weren't his, the bridge doing nothing for the Marines who were already in the city. The word had come from Tokyo, launching the engineers into a frantic rush. The bridge was to be built specifically for MacArthur, allowing the general to make his entrance into the capital with all the grand spectacle of the conquering hero. The jeep tottered precariously past a deep crater, the stench of the explosion still rising.
Smith holding on tightly to the side. Puller leaned back toward him, said, "Sorry, busted shock absorber. That'll be fixed. Wasn't time this morning when we got the word. You'd think there'd be more jeeps, but they were all out doing real jobs. Besides, this one's my favorite." Smith kept his eyes down the side streets, could see Marines in clusters, aid stations, low-level command posts. The smoke was there, too, some of it from blasted houses, piles of rubble where men huddled, watching civilians searching for anything they could find.
"This is madness,"
the words came from Craig, and Puller turned his head slightly.
"Oh, you got that right, Eddie. They made me wear this idiotic helmet, you know. Hate this tin cap, but General Almond insisted. Said it'll make me look like I did the fighting. Jackass."
The jeep wound along more potholed streets. A sudden high bounce, the driver grappling with the steering wheel, Puller offering the man a heavy dose of swearing. But Smith ignored that, too. Knew the driver was probably used to it. They turned down a wider avenue, rubble to one side, and Puller pointed, said,
"Russian tanks rolled through that place there. Half dozen T-34s. Artillery took care of them, or we did. Surprised me, though. Cost me some good men."
Puller paused.
"They're veterans, you know, the North Koreans. All that talk about them running away was crap. The prisoners we picked up said they had fought the Japs. Some of them fought in China. Their weapons weren't new, but they worked just fine. Russian guns. Some of ours, too. Didn't think it would be this tough. But I think we'll have this place secure in another couple of days."
"1 hour's worth, Louis. We need secure for 1 hour. By tonight, you can do whatever you need to do." There was a thump of artillery, a hard shriek overhead, then another. To one side, a distant burst of machine gun fire. Craig's word rolled through Smith's brain. Madness. Puller didn't respond to Smith's request, didn't have to. Puller knew as much as any of his officers what still needed to be accomplished. They were only taking this jeep ride now because of orders that could only have come from Douglas MacArthur. It had been announced on September 27th that 2 days prior, squarely on the 25th, just as MacArthur had demanded, the capital city of Seoul had been swept clean of enemy soldiers, liberated as promised. The city now to be handed back in a grand and formal ceremony to South Korean President Syngman Rhee. Around MacArthur's headquarters in Tokyo, the newspaper men had scribbled furiously on their pads as the announcement was made. Magnificent news that went out quickly on the wires or by phone, reaching anxious newspapers in the States, to be swallowed whole by Americans who still weren't sure just what this war was about. But pride ran deep, some of that left over from World War II, the certain expectation that our boys would always win, no matter the enemy. MacArthur understood that more than anyone. The power of the positive story. The power of victory. To the reporters, the general had offered praise for the Marines, the Army, his staff officers, anyone who had contributed to the liberation of Seoul. That the city was still engulfed in fighting seemed not to matter to MacArthur at all. Madness. Smith tried to erase the word, saw the government palace looming large in front of them. He rose up in the seat, could see a fleet of staff cars parked in a wide space, great black and green limousines transported from Tokyo. Around the parked cars stood guards in white gloves, crisp, clean army uniforms, also from Tokyo. The cars were a surprise, but the soldiers were there because Smith had not agreed with MacArthur's request that the Marines furnish the manpower. It was one more instance of Smith standing up to Ned Almond, each time scraping a raw wound between them. What Smith knew could become a dangerous, career-ending feud. As the jeep drew closer to the wide compound, he could see the uniforms, starched and perfect, thought, Of course he'd dress them up for the occasion. I couldn't have given him that anyway. Where am I going to get white gloves out here?
There was a guard post at the entrance of the compound, a white-gloved MP stepping out with his hand raised, Puller's driver braking the jeep to a halt. Smith could see that the man was a major, perfect uniform, shined black shoes. Puller rose up in his seat, said,
"What the hell is this, Major?"
"Sorry, Colonel. Only official staff cars are allowed to enter the compound."
"Major, my staff car's in Japan. This is a combat zone. We don't ride around on soft seats."
"Sorry, sir. My orders said only staff cars. I can't allow you to pass."
Smith could feel Puller's heat, said nothing, was wondering just what Puller would do.
Puller said, "Listen, you oak tree. My boys captured this damn place. I don't give a good goddamn what your orders are. Get the hell out of my way."
"Sorry, Colonel. No entry today. My orders."
Puller shouted to his driver, "Run him over."
The jeep lurched ahead, Puller flopping down heavily on the seat. Smith pushed backward, nearly tumbling out of the jeep. The MP danced quickly aside, wide eyes, then began to follow, loud shouts. Smith watched the man until he gave up the chase, but Puller was still angry. Looked back at Smith.
"We'll stop on our way out. Apologize to him, if you tell me to."
Smith shook his head.
"Nope. I'd have done the same thing you did."
He knew that wasn't true. Saw the look on Puller's face, that Puller knew better as well. Puller stabbed his pipe into his mouth, said to the driver,
"Pull over there, Jones, behind that Cadillac. Maybe they'll give you a parking ticket.
That'll be fun. You stay here, though. We might be in enough hot water already, and, Private, you're not dressed properly."
"Thank you, sir."
The man was clearly relieved to be left behind, and Smith thought, "I wish I could join you." Puller slid out of the jeep, Smith and Craig behind him, and Craig said, "Colonel, maybe next time put your rank on the jeep?"
"Why? They made me wear this damn tin cap. They can see my bird quick enough."
They walked past the grand cars, every one polished, some with white wall tires, the guards seeming protective of their temporary posts. Puller said to Smith,
"They have no idea what Marines look like. I'll bet you don't draw a single damn salute."
They were inside quickly, and Smith felt very much out of place. Korean men in suits, a sea of perfect uniforms, nearly all of them army. He scanned the crowd, saw Almond, others, almost none of the army officers familiar, except MacArthur. He saw Murray now, with an aide, both men gravitating quickly toward Smith.
"Sir, glad you made it. We seem to be the only Marines in attendance."
Behind him, Smith heard a grunt from Puller, thought, "Keep your head, Louis." At 37, Ray Murray was the youngest of Smith's commanders, and as a lieutenant colonel, was outranked by both Puller and Litzenberg. But no one seemed concerned with the insignia on Murray's shoulder. In World War II, he had earned a pair of Silver Stars and a Navy Cross, had as much combat experience as nearly any officer in Smith's command. There were certainly no complaints how Murray had handled the 5th Marines since they had come ashore at Incheon. Smith scanned the crowd again, said,
"We have seats for this thing, Ray?"
"Yes, sir. They're starting to file into the assembly hall. I suppose we just follow the flow."
He acknowledged both Craig and Puller now, said,
"Louis, it's been a tough couple of days."
Puller grunted again.
"Your boys took Kimpo Airfield in a blink. Damn fine work."
They followed the crowd into the hall, Smith in the lead. Behind him, he heard Puller again, a low voice to Murray.
"I'll be glad when we get this thing over with."
Smith wasn't sure what Puller meant, if he was more concerned with the liberation of Seoul or what was about to happen right now.
"Gentlemen, if I may have your attention."
It was one of MacArthur's aides, a booming voice from the stage.
"Please, be seated."
They sat, the room growing quiet,
and Craig leaned in close to him, said, "You don't suppose he's going to start tossing out medals?"
"Shut up, Eddie."
MacArthur rose to the stage now, and across from him, an old Korean, a slight curl to his back, the ravages of age. It was Syngman Rhee. MacArthur spoke for a half hour, calling for prayer for the success of his men, for the liberation of the Korean capital, for the lives and well-being of every man in his command. During it all, Smith had detected what appeared to be tears streaming down MacArthur's cheeks, a show of emotion that seemed oddly out of place. More than once he thought, "This isn't over yet. The city is still a very dangerous place." But still the ceremony went on, MacArthur ending his remarks with the Lord's Prayer, only to be followed by the United Nations representative and a brief speech by the American ambassador, John Muccio. At last, Syngman Rhee took the stage, generous remarks of his own, concluding with the presentation of some kind of document for MacArthur, a gesture of gratitude that inspired another show of emotion. Throughout the entire ceremony, the thumps of artillery fire punctuated the remarks, some of the impacts on buildings close enough that Smith could hear tumbling concrete. Many of the men in front of Smith reacted with nervous glances, quiet urgency in their hushed voices, Smith knowing that many of these men had never been under fire. By the end of the program, Smith was as eager as Puller and the others to leave, perhaps the only men in the room who understood that the job was still to be completed. It did not escape any of them that through all the talk, the official congratulations, the carefully orchestrated pomp, none of the speakers mentioned the Marines at all. "I'll be leaving for Tokyo in an hour. I've heard some uncomfortable reports that things are dragging a bit. Let's clean this up, shall we?" MacArthur seemed distracted, scanned the departing crowd, a brief nod to a cluster of reporters waiting nearby. Smith said, "We're doing the best we can under the circumstances, sir. The enemy has a talent for defense, and my men are pushing through the city one house at a time." MacArthur seemed not to hear him, said, "Just get the job done." "What did you think of our presentation?" "Quite a show." MacArthur had answered his own question, but Almond broke in.
"Wonderful, sir. President Rhee is a wonderful man. Most grateful to you for what we have accomplished here. Quite spry for such an old man."
Almond's words flowed like syrup, but Smith kept his eyes on MacArthur, tried not to show any reaction. MacArthur nodded slowly, seemed lost in thought for a moment, then said,
"75, he says. They nearly beat him to death in the war. Japanese tortured him. His hands are a mess. He loves us, of course, so we love him back. That's how they think in Washington, you know. He hates Russians as much as we do, so we love him for it. We offer him bouquets and handshakes, those things that make congressmen and newspapermen so very happy." He paused. "They know nothing of what I must do here, nothing at all. And how they've doubted me."
MacArthur seemed to animate now, brought back to the moment. He looked hard at Smith.
"They thought I was a fool. They thought we'd fall on our faces at Incheon."
He gestured toward the reporters waiting at the far end of the hall.
"Now look at them, like schoolchildren, eager for today's lesson. I shall give them one. They will listen, too, write down every word. Not so, those people in Washington. They do not understand what a war is, you know. To them it's budgeting and arguments over treaties. It's why this country needs men in the field who know how to take command, who can make the decisions, all of the decisions."
Smith didn't know what to say, felt as though he wasn't a part of MacArthur's conversation at all. Almond seemed anxious to respond.
"Yes, sir, certainly."
MacArthur looked at Almond, as though for the first time, said,
There is much to do still. Orders will be issued. Make ready for the next phase of this operation, General.
Almond seemed to snap upright.
We are quite ready, sir.
I'll be leaving now. A word to the newspapers first, but I must return to Tokyo.
He looked at Smith now, saw Puller behind him with the others.
Fine work. Truly outstanding. You have earned the gratitude of your nation. I will see to that.
MacArthur moved away, and Smith watched the man's gait. A hint of unsteadiness. A slight shake in MacArthur's hand. Almond moved closer to Smith, spoke in quick, hushed words.
Clean this place up, Smith. We're going north, and I want no laces left untied. Your orders will come very soon. I expect them to be carried out with all speed.
Smith nodded, thought, that word again.
We will continue to do our best, sir.
Almond moved away, chasing MacArthur, who stood tall, the reporters gathering close. Smith had desperate need of a deep breath, backed away, watching the scene, making certain MacArthur didn't suddenly want him by his side.
Don't be foolish, he thought. We're not even a sideshow in this place.
As the fighting continued around Seoul, the enemy seemed finally to give way, and another blow to North Korean hopes emerged from farther south. For weeks, the North Koreans had waged a vicious war against Walton Walker's Eighth Army, a combination of American and United Nations troops. Walker's forces had taken the first great shock from the North's invasion, had been mostly overwhelmed, shoved backward into a tight squeeze around the southeastern corner of the peninsula, what was now called the Pusan Perimeter. But the amphibious landing at Incheon had accomplished MacArthur's objective, had driven a sharp wedge behind the enemy besieging Walker. As part of MacArthur's overall strategy, Walker's forces were to launch a well-coordinated breakout of their own, coinciding with the amphibious landing of the Marines at Incheon. To the surprise of most of the American military planners, who had been taught by MacArthur to have little confidence in Walker, the Eighth Army breakout of Pusan was successful. Whether or not MacArthur would give credit to Walker, a man he deeply disliked, the breakout seemed to show that the North Koreans, with their supply lines cut, their ammunition running low, their rations disappearing, were mostly used up. For Oliver Smith, the mopping up soon cleared Seoul of any significant pockets of the enemy. The Marines finally able to stand down, reorganize the smaller units, deal with their casualties. From the time Douglas MacArthur had claimed the liberation of Seoul until the city was actually cleared of fighting, the Marines suffered more than 700 additional casualties. Whether anyone in Tokyo wanted to hear that, Smith knew the war in Korea had already become a nasty, bloody affair. In Smith's headquarters and all through the 1st Marine Division, optimism followed the victory. At higher levels, many in Korea, Tokyo, and Washington allowed themselves to believe that the retreat of the North Koreans from both Pusan and Seoul meant the end, that diplomats would now take charge, that the two sides would return to some kind of agreement that kept Korea divided along the 38th parallel. But Douglas MacArthur had a very different notion of how this war should end.
Chapter 6. Riley. Near Wijongbu, South Korea, October 3, 1950. The prisoners climbed up from the holes, their hands high, Riley keeping the M1 aimed at the lead man. He saw the face clearly, hard eyes. Something about the North Korean that said, nasty. The prisoner was older than the others, but there was nothing in his clothing that showed rank.
To one side, Lieutenant Goolsby made a verbal count, the line lengthening as the prisoners continued to emerge from the blasted hole. 12, 13, 14, God, they smell. An MP stood close by, another lieutenant, a squad of his men waiting expectantly. Riley saw the youth on their faces, no older than Morelli. From the deep hole came a woman now, then another, both young, very pretty. The Marines were caught by surprise, the inevitable comments coming. Hey, she's a cutie. Whoa, sister, I got your bayonet right here. Behind Goolsby, Welch called out, Knock it off. The sergeant moved forward, closer to the MP officer, said, Sir, I'd be careful with these. They're more dangerous than the men. They're not soldiers, but I bet they're armed. The MP seemed annoyed that a non-com could tell him anything he didn't know. We'll handle this, Sergeant. The lieutenant pointed at the first woman, an MP approaching her. His carbine dropped low, a hand out. Hey there, missy. You let me check you out, okay? The woman spun around, one hand flashing through her filthy dress, the grenade there, the MP lunging forward, tackling the woman, a flurry of dust and shouting. Riley moved forward quickly, but the MPs were there first. The grenade pulled away, a hard punch to the woman's face. The second woman stayed still, watching stoically, and Riley could see the anger, the raw viciousness of her expression. The MPs spread out now, moving to the male prisoners. No talk at all, no need for words. One was punched hard in the stomach, the Korean curling over with a grunt, collapsing to his knees, twisted pain on his face. An MP pulled the man up by the shirt, ripped it from the man's back, tossed it aside. He glanced at his lieutenant, who said, Go on, all of them, strip them down. The MP jerked at the man's pants, sliding them to the ground, another quick jerk, stripping away his underclothes. The Korean stood naked, the MP motioning to the other prisoners with the muzzle of his carbine. They seemed to understand, pulling off their clothes, resigned to their captivity. Around Riley there were low comments, Riley sharing a nagging discomfort. But the MPs were firmly in charge, the clothing tossed aside, the Koreans now completely stripped. The lieutenant moved to the silent woman, held his pistol in his hand, aimed it at her face, then slowly pointed downward, touching her chest. Off! Riley felt a twinge of sickness, thought, Good God, what's he doing? The woman glanced at the other prisoners, the men cupping their hands at their groins, and said something in Korean, then pulled at her blouse. In seconds, she was as naked as the men, and she turned to the injured woman, a hard shout, short words, the woman undressing as well. No one spoke. The Koreans staring at the men who stared at them. The women seeming more defiant than the men. The other MPs moved up, poking at the clothing with the carbines, one man bending low. Right here, sir, another grenade. Hell of a knife, too.